Essay 1. There is a stand of woods about 5 miles from here, one large enough to be better measured in square miles than in acres. It is named after William Boyce, the founder of the Boy Scouts, which is why it is called Boyce Park. The park includes many recreational amenities, but the part of it I'm talking about is really just a big woods, like the kind that surrounded the town I grew up in and through which I wandered happily back then. Those casual, loose-fitting natural spaces that sit halfway between large urban parks, of which Pittsburgh has several, some wild enough to get lost in, but visibly carved into and cultivated by human engineering, and wilderness areas, like the Allegheny Forest, say, a long drive from here, rich with old-growth trees and prime for day-long, strenuous hiking. In the woods, the trees are on the younger side, smaller, maybe a foot or two in diameter, relatively densely packed, hundreds and thousands of them, creating a visually deepening space that evaporates gradually into infinity. The topography through and among them crisscrossed by a maze of foot-worn dirt paths arranged more like randomly crazed paint than logically organized avenues for transit. Paths that surely emerged and evolved serendipitously, organically, glued to the features of the landscape that allowed for the easiest rather than the most efficient passage from one place to another. Paths that one can, when so inclined, as I sometimes am, imagine a Native American might have traversed on his way from one tent or village to another. Paths made by and for walking. I love these woods, these walks, and so did Carol. We started walking daily in this particular one about 10 years ago. Rain or shine, hot or cold, about 4 miles typically on a combination of intersecting paths that varied from day to day, guided mostly by our collaborative whim. After Carol passed last winter, it took me more than a month to overcome the resistance of my sadness enough to return. Now, 8 months later, I'm back at it every day, by myself, of course, but in many important respects, still with her as well, in this sense. Carol was like me in that she really enjoyed what Socrates calls ethereal speculation, stargazing, that scattered sort of thinking without a purposive goal, motivated more by curiosity than results, the free play that comes before argument, writing, work.
She would talk with me, excitedly, exploringly,
about all manner of philosophical, psychological, artistic, or just plain human matters, without inhibition or plan. Or conversely, she could stay comfortably silent for long stretches in my company. That's what we did on those walks, one or the other, in an unpredictable rhythm. Since I spent most of my free time alone with her, this was my idea of normal. I tried after she passed to start up such conversations with friends and colleagues, or to sit with them in silence, expecting it just to take. As best I could tell, the effect was more confusing, even unnerving, than engaging, as if I were violating some of the essential conventions, ones I either never knew or had long forgotten, that regulate social intercourse in the normative world. So I stopped. On these daily walks, though, I still live in that relationship with Carol, with time, with nature, with language. I talk animatedly to myself, often out loud, in gesticular fashion, about all manner of things, a torrent of words that would surely sound nonsensical, maybe maniacal, to anyone who wasn't in on it every day. Or, by turns, I simply inhabit the vastly rich experiential places that one can only navigate a way through in deep, full silence. I rarely encounter another walker on my way, so none of this is either embarrassing to me or impertinent to anyone else. Today's walk was a good example. I was thinking, quite entertainingly, about the relationship between art and life, a conundrum that has always engaged my thinking, and Carol's too, as I assume it must for most others in a profession like mine, in which we promote the great value of textual artifacts, our domain in the kingdom of art, to audiences who, while skeptical, are at least tentatively hopeful about their potential to illuminate their lives worrying on outside of our interventions. There are, of course, an array of cultural and philosophical matrices that regulate our merging through the mental traffic as we move back and forth from one lane, art, to the other, life. But today, I was thinking about it in more personal terms. Specifically, how such texts help or don't someone in my shoes, or someone who has to face someone in my shoes. If we read literary texts for a reason, what is it? They cannot, or at least should not, simply be alternatives to, or escapes from, the realities of life and death, talismans to delude us into thinking reality can be safely forgotten or ignored when it rears its head in front of us. Are these stories, poems, plays, movies supposed to enliven us with experiences as a mode of enrichment, carrying their weight over into our daily lives, helping us cope and helping us help others cope? And what then is the status of such an experience, by comparison, for example, with the one like my walk in the woods, which is not being induced from without by an extant text from which I am absent as a character? I started to think through some of this last spring in my essay, Coming to Terms, and I was digging deeper into that muddle in ways that would now take too many pages to document. But that is not my purpose here. What I want to talk about is this. At one point, walking fast, head down, looking vacantly at the ground, I began to think about Walt Whitman, whom I will be teaching in a few days, and particularly about his extraordinary way of organizing relationships between things we stereotypically might say are either inside us or outside us, bringing them into confluence with one another, even full merger from time to time. Just at that moment, I noticed at my immediate left, alongside the path, a single wildflower, tall-stalked, with large, arrowhead-shaped leaves, thin stems, upon each of which was perched a dime-sized, daisy-shaped flower in the most subtle and lovely shade of purple. I stopped to consider it, at least in part, I think, because that's exactly what Whitman would invite me to do. Then I noticed that there were several other such plants in the immediate vicinity, each with its own array of 4, 5, 6 of these flowers. When my gaze wandered up the steep slope on that side of the path, I saw they were everywhere. Galaxies of these glorious starburst flowers spiraling up over the cusp of the hill. I was stunned, breathtaken, filled utterly to the brim with elation. I stopped thinking, stopped talking, was empty of language, full of thankfulness. I felt on the verge of tears, but knew that was merely a figurative way in which my body was reacting, out of gladness rather than sadness, and all of which was simultaneously present in my embodied experience of this exhilarating moment, extending its temporal reach casually toward me as I reached back to grasp and gather in this spectacle. I believe now that if I had not been thinking about my problem du jour, this conundrum about art and life, and specifically about Whitman at that moment, and more endemically, as a foundational matter of fact in my unfathomable internal constitution, about my beautiful wife whom I have loved and lost, I could not have experienced all of that. But it was clear to me also that had I not glanced off to the side, outside the perimeter of my thinking, none of any of what was present there would have taken me into the moment that went its leisurely way with me. I'm not sure how long I stood there, or thereafter how long it took me to traverse the next 50 yards of the path, which were similarly surrounded, enveloped by these delicate blooms. but after some while, it was over, and I was on my way. All I can say is this. If we read for reasons, this must be one of them. I have no clear idea about the life part of my original equation, whether there are reasons for that too. I hope so. But even if we only make them up ourselves to ease our way in the ways of others who have to journey with us here, this is a good place to anchor. Maybe it's just a scrim that makes it possible for such serendipitous moments as this to weave their way into and through the time we spend here, making it momentarily and memorably magical. The brief verbal sketches that follow here document intervals like this from some of my walks this fall. An unpredictable tapestry made from what I'm seeing, reading, teaching, remembering. I'm sad to have to write them. If Carol were walking with me, I wouldn't need to. And I'd still think I was normal.